Okay. Philippians 4, 6, and 7 are quoted a lot. And so let's read those. Philippians chapter 4, verse 6. Paul says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." Okay, I want us to begin by considering pretty carefully what he says in verse 6, because I think it's challenging in at least two ways. Number one, it's challenging in that what exactly does it mean? And secondly, once we figure out exactly what it means, how do we do that? So think about what he says at the very beginning in verse 6. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. Be anxious for nothing. Now, my question to you here is, and I hope somebody helps me with this, because I stewed over this quite a while. This verse makes me feel inadequate, because I'm anxious a lot about a lot of stuff. And what I want to know is Paul telling Christians to do something that is impossible? When he says, be anxious for nothing. What is he saying? And all of you all who have family members, if you're parents, you have children, are you ever anxious about your children? I would guess if you have young children, you're anxious about them every day. Some of you have relatives somewhere in a hospital. Do you ever get anxious about their condition? Sometimes we hear about people who are in accidents and they're in hospitals and they might or might not live. Is it a sin for us to be anxious about those people? Some people have relatives who are off in war and they're worried about their safety and they're anxious. Is Paul saying we shouldn't be anxious about those people? So is he asking us to do something that you say, well, that's nice. We'll shoot for that, but we'll never do it. Aha. Chuck? No, don't ask me, could he be? You need to make a declarative statement here. That's a really good comment. Anybody else want to make a comment along that? Larry? Okay, hang on a minute. Larry has gone to Matthew 6:25, where Jesus, in that whole chapter, made similar comments to what Paul said. And Larry, you're going to speak up a little bit so everybody over here can hear what you're saying. He talks about in that chapter food, drink, and clothing. Good comment. Anybody else? Scott? Thank you. Okay, now I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. I agree with it. But where does finding out that your child is in the hospital with a 105-degree fever, how does that enter into your... Do you know any parents who love their kids who would not be worried if they found out their kid had 105 fever? It's not fair for you to ask me questions. All right, let me throw a few little pieces of information at you, and let's see if this enhances our understanding of this. The Greek word here for anxious, is that what, yeah, it says be anxious. That really is the gist of what the word means. But the Greek word is something called merimna. How do you say that, Larry? Is that right? M-E-R-I-M-N-A is the English word, merimna. And I'm not a Greek scholar, but I've got books. And the definition of that, according to Vine's Dictionary, is care or concern, especially concern that is so deep that it's an anxious concern. So that's where the New American Standard translators get anxiety. I guess we could also throw in worry in there. But a true, explicit definition of this would be care, extreme care. So I looked up what the Greek text had to say, the interlinear, and it says, literally, this is, be careful about nothing. Now, nowadays, we tell people, well, be careful. You know, you're getting ready to go off somewhere. Well, be careful. And that's a nice thought, but it's not nearly as comprehensive as what this word originally was, where somebody is to care for somebody else. Now, I thought it was interesting. We've already read, Paul's used this word another time in Philippians. Look in chapter 2, verse 28. And Paul's talking there, no, I'm sorry, verse 20. Paul's talking there about sending Timothy back to Philippi. And here's what he says, why Timothy would have been a good choice to go. For I have no one else of kindred spirit who will genuinely be concerned for your welfare. And that's the same word. I have no one else of kindred spirit who would genuinely care for your welfare. So that's the same word. Now the thing is, if Paul is saying, never care and never worry and never have any anxiety, then he's contradicted himself by saying Timothy'd be a good guy to come back to Philippi because he has care for you all. It's the same word from which we get the anxiety. And look at another thing that Paul wrote over in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians 11, 28. Paul is talking about all the problems that he deals with. And in verse 28, he says, apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure on me of concern for all the churches. Same word, anxiety for all the churches. So if Paul means that never are we to have this extreme concern for somebody else to where we never feel anxiety, then he's not doing very well at living it himself. Because he said in two places, Philippians and Corinthians, that Timothy was a good guy because he's anxious for them. And he's saying here that he's anxious for a whole bunch of churches. Somebody mentioned that right at the beginning. Now let me tell you what really got me going on this, about what did Paul mean here, is, and we won't turn to this, but you know what I'm going to talk about probably. In Mark 14, 33 and 34, the Bible says Jesus was very distressed and troubled. And he says, Jesus says in verse 34 of Mark 14, my soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Now you can say, well, it doesn't say anxiety, but that's playing word games. The Bible describes Jesus as distressed and troubled, and he says his soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Now, if that's not anxiety, I don't know what anxiety is. So Jesus felt it. Then in Luke 22:44, before the crucifixion, it says, and being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. Now you're telling me that wasn't anxiety? Of course it was. Jesus had anxiety. Paul had anxiety. Timothy had anxiety. So there is something about this passage in Philippians 4 that not having anxiety does not stand alone. Stacy.
I feel like you have to take all of 6 and 7 together.
Yes. Okay, well, these are great comments. This is what I was hoping you all would do, is help me understand this. But the reason why I bring this up is I don't know anybody that doesn't stress and worry. There are a whole lot of things that I still worry about. Sometimes it won't do any good, and sometimes it's about things that I know I've done successfully many times in the past, but I got to do it one more time, and I still have trouble sleeping the night before it has to happen. I mean, somebody says, well, you need to go have a medical test. You don't think I have a little stress over that? I say, well, okay, worst can happen is they say, well, you're going to die tomorrow. And okay, I'm going to die and I'm going to heaven. So I'm going to not worry about it. I still worry about it. Larry? Yes. Well, and you know that there are things that Christians have that we're responsible for. You know, I put down here 1 Timothy 5:8, if anyone does not provide for his own, especially those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So a father has a responsibility to provide for his family. He has to care about them. He can't say, well, I hope God provides some food for us tomorrow, and the cereal appears on the table. Okay, I think Stacy hit several of you hit good points, but Stacy hit a really good one here, and that is that this little sentence, be anxious for nothing, is not a standalone sentence. I think what Paul is doing here, he is clearly addressing anxiety about things that we attempt to face alone. That's what he's saying, I think, in this verse, and several of you have touched on that. He's talking about an anxiety. Don't be anxious in a way where you are trying to solve these things alone without taking into account that God is willing to help you. and without even asking him to help you, because he said if you ask him, he will help you with this. And you're allowing the anxiety you feel about whatever it is to overwhelm you, and you lose sight of the fact that you're not doing this alone. I think that's what he's saying. Now, let's see if that makes sense. Let's read it again and see if that makes sense to you all. Be anxious for nothing, but, indicating a contrast, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. Does that make sense? He's saying, don't stress out on all this stuff by yourself. But with thanksgiving in your heart for what God has already done for you, ask him to keep on helping you. And in fact, Peter talks about that. Look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7. Well, let's start with 6. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety, and there's that word again, merimna, casting all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you. So I think Peter, 1 Peter 5, 7 can serve as a commentary on what Paul says in Philippians 4, 6. So the reason why I bring it up is our world's full of stress. We worry about all kinds of stuff. Sometimes we worry about dumb stuff. Other times we worry about really important stuff. You know, if I've got a child in the hospital with 105 fever and he's been in there for 3 days and they can't get it down, I'm going to worry about that. But I'd be a fool to worry about that by myself and not ask God to help me and help him and help me deal with that. I think that's what Paul is saying to the Philippians here. Anybody else want to comment on that? Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, that was... Anybody not at peace with that way of understanding this? I'm at peace with it. Okay. Now, let's look at verse 7. Because here's a verse that we hear quoted a lot. And it's a great verse. And the peace of God... And we know what that is. We got that from back in chapter 1, first couple of verses. Peace of God is when we're at peace, not just because we're mentally at peace and we don't have any worries, but we're at peace with God because the sin that separated us from him has been reconciled thanks to the sacrifice of Jesus. So we're at peace with God. So that's what he's talking about here. The peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. So, the words here for hearts and minds are very similar in the Greek. They're two different words, but they are similar. And both of them refer to the inner being of emotion of man. Man's inner emotion, where we think and we feel and we make decisions and we make choices about which path we're going to go down. That's what that means. So he says something is going to happen. This peace of God is going to guard your hearts and minds. Okay, my question to you is, when you feel anxiety, whether it's good anxiety or dumb anxiety, and we all have both, where does that happen in your person? What happens in your inner self where you're thinking and feeling and having emotions and making decisions and reacting to what's going on around you? That's where all that happens. And what he's saying is, that the peace of God, this knowing, ultimately, that all this stuff on earth is going to pass away, and ultimately, we're going to heaven, and we have the kind of relationship with God that if our life ended now, we would be with him. Knowing all of that, he says, it will guard your hearts and minds. So all that's happening in our inner self, the essence of us, the essence of our emotion, the essence of our cognition, I don't know how you'd put it into psychological terms, but it's the very inner being of the essence of us that makes us who we are. How we react, how we feel, how we choose, how we determine our loyalties, all that sort of thing. And he says, if you've got that peace that comes from God by being in that condition, in that relationship with him, then it's going to help guard your heart, the inner essence of yourself, against all these stresses that you're dealing with. Now, if you take that to the ultimate end, What that means is there is nothing that can happen down here on this earth that can totally stress us out and overwhelm us, because we know even if somebody says, I'm going to shoot you, well, I got to tell you, if somebody holds a gun to my head and says they're going to shoot me, I'm going to stress. Until they pull the trigger, then I'm not going to feel it. Hopefully their shot will be accurate, and we'll get this over with. But what I know is, in the most stressful physical condition, God's spiritual peace helps me deal with it all. And that's the peace that passes all understanding. Well, why does it pass all understanding? Well, I'll tell you why. Because man can't fathom the fact that God would send Jesus down here, his son, to die on the cross so that I can have that peace. That peace that you and I have by having that relationship with God surpasses all understanding. It doesn't surpass God's understanding, but it surpasses ours, because we can't fathom that something like that would happen that we profit from. Larry? Well, I think that makes sense. Does anybody want to make a comment or ask a question about that? I mean, it's no wonder this verse is quoted so much, because the peace that passes all understanding is something that I can't understand. Okay. Well, it's interesting. Jesus, when it talks about in Mark 14 and Luke 22, when he was distressed and in agony, what did he do? In the garden, he prayed to the Father, which is exactly what Paul is telling us to do. Go to the Father for help. And that's exactly what Jesus did. Amazing. Well, anybody have any suggestions on how we can deal more effectively with the stressors of daily life? We face them. I think generally we can say we can do what Paul said and think about, yeah, this is bad. And it might be really bad, but it's temporary, because ultimately it's all going to have a happy ending. Okay, let's look at verses 8 and 9. Interesting verses here. In verses 8 and 9, he is talking about two categories of things. And I say thing, that's a crummy term. That's best I can do. But in 8, he's talking about things that a Christian should think about. In 9, he's talking about things that a Christian should do. So he divides it into two ways. And what he's given here is little kernels of advice and teaching to the Philippians before he finishes this letter. They're wonderful kernels, but they're pretty short. Verse 8, here's what Christians ought to think about. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there's any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. And the word dwell, I like the way King James said, think on these things. But the Greek word for this could literally be ponder. And when you ponder, a good old country saying would be stew on it. Ponder these things means think about it, meditate on it, dwell on this kind of stuff. Don't just give it a casual glance. And then 9, after he tells us what to think about, then he tells us what to do. The things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. There's the peace again. So let's look at these things in verse 8. There are several ways to look at this, and I'll tell you the way I break it down, and you can agree or disagree. If you disagree, feel free to say something. But he gives us these six things, first of all, and then he changes his grammatical construction here in verse 8. He says, here's some things to think about, six of them, brethren. What is true, what is honorable, what is right, what is pure, what is lovely, what is of good repute. Those are the six things to think about. And then he changes the grammatical construction, which makes me think that these next two things are not part of the list, but they're a general thing. If there's any excellence And if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. So I think he gives us a list of six things, and then he tells us a general thing of these last two things. And I did a word study on this to see what Vine had to say about these words. Let me just run through what I got out of it. First of all, he says, whatever is true. Think about this. This ought to occupy your thoughts, he says. And those are things that the Christian knows to be true. It's not just think about statements that are true. It's think about truths that you know. And Paul has told them some truths. We're talking about religious, spiritual truths. Jesus was the Son of God. He came to earth, Philippians 2 tells us, was the epitome of humility, gave up all the glory of being deity, and died on the cross. He rose, and he's coming back. And those are spiritual truths. And that's not relative, doesn't change, it's true. And he tells them, think about whatever is true. Then he says, whatever is honorable. And best I could get out of that is things that are characterized, I like this one, things that are characterized by dignified seriousness. It's honorable. It's worthy of our respect. Then whatever is right comes from a Greek word, dikaios, which means right or just conduct as determined by God. This word is used in a familiar passage to us in Ephesians 6:1, where it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Well, who decided that was right? God did. So we're to think about things that are right. Well, how are we going to know those things that are right? Well, we go to the book that's full of rightness as well as righteousness. That's a clever pun, and I didn't even think about it, but just accidentally did it. Then whatever is pure, and based on what I found from the word study, those are things that are free from worldly contamination and sin. Think about pure things. Then whatever is lovely, those are things that are pleasing or attractive for wholesome reasons. And then whatever is of good repute, and that's pretty much what it says, things that have a good reputation. So those are things that are to occupy a Christian's thoughts. And then the last two things there, excellence, is moral excellence. Comes from the Greek word arete, virtue or moral excellence. And then things that are worthy of praise is things that would be praised by people who love God, would be that. Okay, so another way to put this would be let your mind dwell on these things. And what that tells us is, does a Christian have an ability to make a choice as to what kind of things we think about? And it appears that we do. It appears that we do. Proverbs 23:7, as a man thinks, so is he. So why is that a big deal? Why is that important? Why is it important that we have the ability to choose? And so what? What difference does it make what we think about? Doesn't make any difference. Well, what's in our heart and what we think about and what we fill our mind and our awareness with is probably going to indicate what we're going to choose. What's in our heart is probably going to be what comes out of our mouth. And he's saying here, y'all want to know what to think about? Want to know how to live the Christian life? All right, I'll give you some things to think about, and here they are. Think about these things. Now, a question I would have for you all, and probably it's an obvious question, what is it that prevents us from thinking about this stuff? In 2017, what kind of things prevent us from thinking about things that are pure and lovely and right and all that? What gets in the way? Okay. You know, it's intriguing to me that 2,000 years ago, Paul felt compelled to write to the people in Philippi, here are some things that you need to be thinking about. Now, compared to our country in 2017, it was really easy to think about good things back then, a whole lot easier than it is today. And the reason is we are bombarded with filth all the time. And a lot of times we're not looking for it, but we still get it. It's in all the media. They didn't have TV back then. They didn't have crummy movies. They didn't have all kinds of crummy stuff. They didn't have lousy radio programs with filth on them or television shows with filth on them. They didn't have billboards with filth on it. They didn't have any of that. I think it's a real challenge for us. I mean, I think thinking on pure and lovely things all the time is really hard. How can we work on that? Anybody got a suggestion? Scott? I'm not Scott. Wait a minute. David Hosey. Yeah, I've known you for just a couple of weeks or two or maybe 30 years. Okay, good comment. Anybody else? Okay, I would suggest to you that being a Christian is a wonderful, wonderful experience with the ultimate blessing happening after we leave this life. However, it's not effort-free. I think we have to work at being Christians. I think it gets harder every day. The more the devil figures out ways to throw garbage at us, the harder it is to think about things that are lovely and pure and right. And it's not carefree. It requires our purposeful effort. Well, verse 9, I mentioned, as Aid was talking about thoughts, verse 9 is about actions. And I think it goes back to what we talked about last week. The things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things. Well, what are those things? I think it's the spiritual teaching of Christianity that God taught them through Paul and Timothy and the other preachers who were there in Philippi and other places. That's what he says. And it shows the power of example here, because he says, also the things you have seen in me. Now, couldn't Paul have totally undermined and destroyed everything he taught if he didn't live the life he taught? Everybody says, did you hear about Paul? He's gotten into a lot of trouble over there in Ephesus or Rome or wherever it is. Heard he was drunk, heard he did this, heard he did that. The power of example is unbelievable. So Paul says that the things that you've learned from me, the things you've received, the things you've heard, and the things you've watched me do, practice these things. Any comments, questions about that? Well, not only is it impressive that he's saying don't be anxious, he also says multiple times, rejoice. And he talks about how he's rejoicing. How in the world could he rejoice sitting in that prison cell? And how in the world could he not be anxious? wonderful example for us. Well, thank you very much. You all have made this class very productive. I appreciate it. Next week will be our last time.